Chapter 8. Long days and nights of darkness. The temperature drops to well below anything Silke has ever experienced. She continues working in the hospital, never far from her guilt, trying to assuage it by smuggling back food for the women in the hut. Bread, vegetables, margarine, real tea, just enough for them to eat each evening, lest there is another raid by Klavdia Arsenyevna. Antonina Karpovna gets a larger portion than Silke's hutmates each night. Over the next few months, Silke absorbs all that she is shown and told at the hospital, like a sponge. She becomes so good at giving injections that patients start requesting her. They will often wait, desperate, until she is free to tend to them. The fact she is minimizing pain rather than exacerbating it is a wonder for Silke. She does still try to remember, as the ward overfills with desperate, frostbitten patients, that she cannot do more than she can do. And still, often, her mind goes blank and she runs on automatic, like an engine. Yelena notices and tells her to take breaks, but if she could stay at the hospital 24 hours a day, she thinks she would. Returning each night to her hut brings conflicting emotions. Not wanting to leave her patients, needing to see Josie and the other women, to know they have made it through another day of carrying, stacking, lifting, picking, their eyes streaming tears from the icy wind onto the fabric wrapped across their faces. She leaves earlier than the women and comes back later, so she does not have to sit idly while they wrap and unwrap themselves, aching, head to foot. And then there are the frequent nighttime visits by the men. Always outnumbered, the other women have very few nights off, the men coming into their hut changing often. Silke and Josie's protected status as the camp wives of Boris and Vadim keeps them from being brutalised by others, though not protected from the cries of their hut mates. One evening, Josie laments to Silke that she is unhappy at Vadim's failure to appear, finding herself jealous that he has other women he prefers to her. This is difficult for Silke to hear. She does not want to tell Josie how to feel. She knows how this abuse can affect a woman, a girl, in many unforeseen ways. But she does say that if she were her, she would feel only relief when he stays away. After a 5-day absence, Boris and Vadim enter the hut. Josie jumps up, screaming at Vadim, accusing him of being unfaithful. Vadim slaps her hard in the face before pushing her down on the bed. Silke is shocked. Is Josie losing her mind? She doesn't want Josie to be killed. She wants to hit Vadim herself, feels that fire burning inside her, but instead, later, she simply cautions Josie to be careful. It feels wrong and inadequate, but she doesn't know what else to do. For the next few days, Josie ostracizes her, making comments to the others about the easy life Silke has in the hospital. The thaw in their relationship has frozen back over. Elena, one night, loudly tells Josie to grow up. They are all benefiting from the extra food Silke smuggles to them from the hospital, the uneaten patient meals she has become expert at hiding in her clothing. Indeed, each night she comes in and empties her pocket on the edge of her bed, quickly breaking up the food so no one else has to do it and be accused of uneven portions, then turns away as the women leap forward and snatch at it. If Antonina is not there, she tucks her portion back in her pocket, as it's rude to leave the temptation out in front of starving eyes. She turns away because it is so hard to see the women's unwrapped, bony fingers snatching. They're chapped, sore-encrusted lips opening, their veiny eyelids closing as they take as long as possible, tasting and chewing the food. Silke gives Elena a small, surprised smile for having come to her defence, though Josie's words sting. Yes, Silke is strangely lucky, but also cursed. If they knew of where she had been for all those years, while they still had an abundance of food and drink and warmth, while they still had families and homes. Elena remains a complex character for Silke. angry, often uncaring, yelling at the world and everyone in it, yet also showing compassion and tenderness on occasions when she is caught off guard. She is just surviving, Silke has often thought. There is no one way to do it. Elena's friend, Hannah, speaking again now she has recovered from her time in the hole, remains more antagonistic. The two women are close because, Silke has found out, they fought in the resistance together, the Polish Home Army, fighting both the Nazis and the Soviets. Silke is intimidated by their bravery, and it makes her even more unwilling to share her past. The next day, Josie hands Silke two small spring flowers she has managed to pick on her way back from the mine. Brilliant purple petals with a red and black centre. Wispy green fronds surround the delicate bloom. Silke has seen them poking through the ice near the hospital. A sign spring is coming. The possibility of relief from the constant freezing, biting wind and snow gives a sense of hope that life might become a bit easier for all of them. Silke tries not to make too much of the gesture from Josie. Truth is, for the first time in here, she feels an aching in her throat, like she is about to cry. She swallows. The flowers are placed in a chipped cup, now the pride of each woman in the hut. They have all learned the art of stealing anything not nailed down, smuggling mugs from the mess, a small table discarded from an officer's hut with a broken leg propped up on random bits of timber, a battered kettle of permanently boiling water on the stove. Antonina, sharing in the uneaten food Silke brings from the hospital, has chosen to ignore the extras. It seems that whatever contraband Klavdia is looking for, it is not these items. The hut is taking on a cosy appearance. Olga, the embroiderer, who managed not to give the needles back on the first night, has been teaching several others her craft. Threads from the ends of sheets have been taken and turned into beautiful doilies which are strung about the hut. Silke has continued to help herself to discarded bandages, cleaning them in boiling water and donating them to the embroidery group. Several of the scarves that cover the heads of the women have delicate embroidered edges. On their monthly visits to the bath hut, the women hand over their lace-edged scarves along with their outer clothing for de-lousing, while they quickly run a sliver of soap across their bodies and rinse off from a vat of thankfully hot water. Their pubic area hasn't been shaved again after the first time, and they are allowed to let their hair grow back unless they are found to be infested with lice. Most of the women hack their hair short during the bathing sessions. Silke lets hers grow a little longer. The clothes come back, warm and stiffly hung over a pole, and they have to grab them before they are unceremoniously dropped on the floor. Sometimes the stronger women elbow their way to a new scarf or warmer coat, and so the lace detailing begins to spread throughout the wider brigade. Spring is sweet, but too short. The snow that has covered the ground almost since Silke arrived melts quickly as daytime temperatures increase. Now the sun is brilliant, reflecting off the nearby hills. When summer arrives, darkness shrinks down until, one day, there is no night at all. There is no need for searchlights in the yard unless it's very overcast. Some of the women in the hut from further south in Europe react to this phenomenon with panic. It seems to go against nature. The men enter the hut, and now the women have to see them clearly, up close. Several of the women do not hold back, telling them what ugly pigs they are, and are punished for daring to say so. Sleep becomes difficult for some as they struggle to shut their eyes in light as bright as day. Tempers flare, and the harmony of the hut is shattered with both verbal and physical fights breaking out. When Silke is caught with a nodding head by Yelena, the doctor asks how she is coping with the white knights.
"The what?" Silke asks.
"The white knights. We will be in daylight for 24 hours each day for a while. Everyone adjusts differently."
"I can't sleep.
And when I do fall asleep, it's only for short bursts. And others in your hut?
Some are fine, most aren't. Fights seem to break out over nothing. How do you cope?
Though she imagines in the staff quarters where Yelena sleeps, there may be adequate curtains. Your first summer will be your worst. Well, for many, their worst. There are others who never adjust and struggle each year. Some simply go mad. They can't cope with the sleep deprivation, the change in their body rhythms. It does something to their head.
She seems very casual about this, Silke thinks. Could that happen to me?
You'll be fine, Silke. Silke hasn't got used to Yelena's enduring faith in her. You need to make a blindfold and cover your eyes and slowly let your body adjust. Tell the other women to do the same, she says. I'm sure if you look in the linen area, you will find some old blankets that have been thrown out. Take a break, take a pair of scissors, go there and cut up enough strips for the women. All you can do is offer. Silke doesn't need to be told twice. In the linen room, she experiments with blankets and other materials she finds until she is happy with the comfort level of having something wrapped around her head. Not too itchy, not too smelly. 20 lengths are cut and stuffed throughout her clothing. It's incredible to even be using scissors. In the hut, the women sometimes cut material by running a just blown out match along it. That night, a Sunday, where they have only had a half day of work, Silke distributes the blindfolds, and the women start to settle in their beds, the hut still lit up by daylight. The sound of voices talking outside is heard. They wait for the men to arrive, but the door stays closed. The voices continue. Several women get out of bed and cautiously poke their heads outside. Elena opens the door and the voices grow louder.
What's going on? Silke calls out.
There are people just walking around and talking. It's like a party out there. They all jump out of bed and rush to the door and windows. Everyone fights to get a look. Slowly, they all venture out.
What's happening?
Elena asks a group of women walking past, chatting away.
Nothing, what do you mean?
Why are you outside in the middle of the night? Elena asks.
It's not the middle of the night yet, and we're outside because we can be.
Is this your first summer? One of the women asks.
Yes, Elena tells her. Well, most of us arrived right at the end of the last one.
If you have the energy, you may as well enjoy being outside for a while without having someone standing over you, forcing you to work.
I didn't think it would be allowed.
Rubbish, you stay inside in winter because it's too cold and too dark to come outside. I could read a book out here, if I had a book to read, so why not enjoy it? It won't last for long.
The women wander off.
I thought... Josie stammers.
I guess this is something else our beloved Antonina Karpovna didn't tell us, says Elena.
Come on, let's go for a walk and have a proper look at our prison.
For the first time in a long while, Silke sees smiles on the faces of some of the women. Despite their exhaustion from the work week, they walk, several arm in arm, outside. Silke supposes this will only happen on Sundays when the half day off allows them to be slightly less exhausted. The prisoners gaze at the sky, see the mountains of coal darkening the horizon. They breathe in the fresh air, their enemy in the winter when it sears their throats, burns their lungs. For the first time, they see men milling around together in the central area where the men's and women's camps meet, not posing a threat to them. Some respond to their smiles with a girlish giggle. A sense of freedom comes over them.
Come with me, Silke. We have to find them, an excited Josie squeals.
Find who?
Silke is surprised by the first face that comes into her mind. The messenger she has seen on the odd occasion at the hospital. The brown-eyed man who had been polite when he accidentally ran into her. They haven't spoken, though he has nodded hello a couple of times.
Vadim and Boris, let's find them and walk with them. Won't it be lovely to just walk and talk to them, get to know them, not just...
I don't want to find Boris.
Why can't we just be together? We don't need them, Josie.
Silke has tried to be understanding of Josie's naivety, her need to think of this as a real connection, but it disturbs her greatly.
But I want to see Vadim. Are you coming or am I going on my own? A petulant Josie says.
I'm not interested, Silke says coldly.
Well, if that's the way you feel.
Josie stomps off. Silke watches her go before wandering away on her own. Silke struggles with this freedom. It is so new to her. She keeps looking at the perimeter with its guard towers, looking for guards who could mow them down with their weapons. This is how on edge they felt in that other place. She doesn't know the rules here yet. She is one of the first to go back to what is, to her, the safety of Hut 29. She waits patiently until they all return, particularly Josie, whom she regrets leaving alone, before going to sleep, making sure they are all back. Then she ties on her blindfold. The women continue to murmur happily as they settle, this small freedom giving them a moment of contentment. For 8 weeks, the sun never leaves the sky. Silke begins to relax and properly join in on the Sunday evening strolls around the camp. She, along with the other women in her hut, explores the environment. They keep their whole bodies covered and wrap scarves around their faces to ward off the mosquitoes. She struggles to convince Josie she doesn't need to find Vadim and be with him, that he is not her future. One evening, Hannah begins to walk beside Silke, pulling her away from Josie with a firm grip just above her elbow. Up close, Silke can smell the stale sweat in her clothes, the grease in her hair.
What do you want? Silke asks.
You know, in the war, people like me and Elena worked to resist every oppressing force, the Nazis, the Soviets.
I know, you're a hero.
While some people just lay down and gave themselves over to them, even benefiting from this coupling while watching everyone around them die.
Her grip intensifies on Silke's arm. Silke feels sick.
Hannah keeps walking, forcing Silke to keep putting one foot in front of the other.
I don't know what you're talking about, Silke says, flatly.
I'm not going to give away my source, but that's a nasty little secret you've kept from us.
Silke swallows, feeling fear, rage. It must have been that woman from the train, who had also been in that other place.
So, is it true what this woman was saying? She seemed desperate to tell someone. She didn't seem long for this world.
I have nothing to say to you. Silke spares a thought for the woman who, like her, had survived that other place only to end up here. And worse, who might never leave.
So it is true. You're just a common whore who gets what she wants by sleeping with the scum of mankind. Well, well, well.
You can't hurt me, Hannah. Don't even try, Silke says, looking her in the eye.
I bet you don't want your friends to know. Do you want me to keep your secret?
I want you to go fuck yourself. I couldn't care less what you do or say.
Silke is bluffing to make the secret less appealing to Hannah. But she knows Hannah must be able to feel her shaking under the tight clench of her hand.
I can keep it secret.
For a price.
How often do men come into our hut and rape you? Hannah.
Hannah doesn't answer, keeps her brows furrowed, breathing heavily.
I didn't hear you, Silke says, her voice raised. One man? Several men? How many different men have raped you since we've been here?
It's just what happens here.
Yes, it's just what happens here. It's what happened there to me. I was kept hidden away so the officers would not be seen to be polluting themselves. Do you know what that is like? For you and your family and friends, your whole race, to be treated like animals for slaughter.
Hannah looks away, keeps her face blank.
And did this person who claims to know so much about me say why she was here?
Silke asks.
Yes, I got that out of her. The Russians said they didn't like people who told on others without being asked. So sent her here too.
It seems like you were all weak in the end, all turning on each other.
No one can judge us, Silke says through gritted teeth. You can't know what it was like.
There were only two choices. One was to survive. The other was death.
Hannah chuckles quietly. Silke is seeing double with rage. She should be used to this by now. People creating hierarchies of good and bad, deciding where you fit in.
But that's not all there is it? Hannah says.
Silke looks at her.
Would you really want me to tell the others, Josie, Natalia, Olga, Elena, about your role in the death block?
Silke tries not to let her expression falter.
I thought so, Hannah says. I will tell you what I need, soon, and you will give it to me.
She walks away, across the patchy grass and dirt. Silke looks up at the women standing around in a circle, sharing a rare moment of leisure. Josie turns and smiles at Silke. Silke forces a smile back. She does not want to go back, in her mind, to that other place. She wants to take each day and get through it the best she can with her new friends. She does not want Hannah to ruin this for her. Her gut churns. All too soon, the women wake to frost on the ground. The air is thick and wet in their throats. Silke has now been here a year. Their scarves are put away, their hats and heavy coats retrieved from under their mattress where they have spent the past 2 months. Hannah does not yet seem to have decided on her price for keeping quiet, but she reminds Silke frequently, with a look or a gesture, of what she knows. Silke tries, most of the time, to block from her mind her fear of the women finding out. The transition from autumn to winter is swift. Seasonal rain dampens the ground and the mood. The evening strolls in the camp end, and the women struggle to adjust to only having their own company once again. The rain becomes sleet. The sleet becomes snow. There is constant darkness. The hut feels small and close, with Hannah's knowledge.
Chapter 9. A day for making plans. A day for thinking ahead. For most people, but not for Silke. For the first time today, she writes in a patient's file, January the 1st, 1947. Patient making good progress, expected discharge tomorrow. She hears the words spoken by the doctor, transcribes them, forces a smile as she looks at the man lying in the bed in front of her, his eyes full of tears.
Please, just a little longer. Can I stay a little longer? 2, 3 more days. I am still weak.
The doctor looks at the man without compassion, turning to Silke. What do you think, Silke? Should we let this malingering piece of shit take up a bed some ailing fellow prisoner should have, or kick his sorry ass out of here tomorrow?
Silke has learned the game some of the doctors like to play, involving her, making her the person who determines whether or not a patient gets another 24 hours in a warm hospital bed with nourishing food. She has also learned which doctors might agree to her suggestion that a patient may have a day longer, and which will do the opposite. This doctor often agrees with whatever Silke says. She carefully grants days to the sick and infirm that she never could in her old life. Though in all of these places, it is always one person for another. One person's comfort, one person's food. Nothing is fair.
It is the first day of a new year. Perhaps in the spirit of this, she glances at the file in her hands before continuing, Georgi Yaroslavovich would benefit from an extra day with us. Shall I amend his file to say discharge in 2 days?
Amend. The doctor walks away. Silke glances up at the poster on the wall above the bed. A smiling worker in a sunny field. Liberation through honest toil. She amends the file.
Thank you, Silke Klein. Thank you. Thank you. You are an angel sent from heaven.
Silke winks at him,
This time her smile is genuine. It's all right, Georgi Yaroslavovich. You know I'll take care of you. As she walks back to the desk to drop off Georgi's file and collect another, Yelena is waiting, having watched the game play out.
Silke, I have some good news for you.
The smile returns to Silke's face. She's almost too scared to ask what. She waits.
I've spoken to the head of the hospital and convinced him you now qualify to be called a nurse.
Really? That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Silke says. But she feels numb. Her position makes a marginal difference to her hutmates' lives, but still she wishes she could do more. Behind Yelena, outside the frosted window, there is howling darkness.
I don't know what else to say.
You don't have to thank me. You did the hard work. You've earned the right to be recognised for it. There is churning deep down inside her. Something like shame. Would Yelena feel differently if she knew everything about Silke's past?
I won't let you down, Silke says.
I know you won't. And Silke, one more thing. She hands a note to Silke. Give this to Antonina Karpovna tonight. It is my request for Josie to start work here tomorrow as a clerical assistant. She will learn some of your old duties to free you up for nursing. Taking the note with a shaking hand, Silke turns away to compose herself. Finally. She has been agitating for this to happen for as long as she has been in the hospital. She stuffs the note in the pocket of her hospital apron. With a nod of thanks, she picks up another file and walks briskly, with purpose, to another patient. For the first time in a long while, Silke arrives back at her hut before the others. She paces the small room, her nose still aching from the cold of the walk, waiting for Josie, for Antonina, to share her news. It is not the news that she is to be called a nurse that excites her so. It is that Josie will no longer be working outdoors, but in the comfort and warmth of the hospital. She knows it comes from a selfish place. She wants to be closer, physically, to Josie, so she can watch over her. The women enter the hut in a state of fear and panic. Silke's first thought is of Hannah, what she knows, or thinks she knows. Has she told the women, and are they going to attack her? But then she realises it is something else entirely. One of the women is sobbing and groaning at the same time. She is being supported by two others, each holding her up by one arm as the woman doubles over in pain. The others are in a fluster, issuing instructions on what to do, with no one listening, no one taking control. Silke grabs Elena, pulling her from the pack. She sees now that the groaning woman is Natalia, her blonde hair stuck with sweat and soot to her forehead.
What's happening? What's wrong?
Antonina has followed them in. As they place Natalia on her bed, they step away and let the brigadier see her.
How far gone? Antonina asks.
Natalia shakes her head in pain and fear.
I don't know.
Her scarf is still bundled around her neck. Her gloved hands clutch at it.
Weeks or months?
Months, 5 or 6. I don't know. Help me. Please help me.
What's wrong with her? Silke asks Elena again.
She's bleeding and she's pregnant. We think she's having the baby.
Antonina looks up and sees Silke standing back.
Come here, she says. You work in the hospital. Take charge. The rest of you, get ready to go to dinner.
Silke opens her mouth to object, changes her mind. She has no idea how to deliver a baby, but she wants to be there for Natalia.
Excuse me, Antonina Karpovna, can I have Josie and Elena stay and help me? I have a note here for you from the doctor, Yelena Georgievna.
Silke unfolds it and puts the note in Antonina's gloved hands. Antonina reads it and looks around to find Josie, says in monotone,
Well, another one of you wins a prize. Congratulations.
She looks back at Silke.
The two of them can stay with you. I'll have some towels and sheets sent over. The rest of you, get out!
She wraps her scarf back over her mouth, only her eyes showing. Before the women leave for the mess, Silke says,
Can I ask if anyone here has had a baby or attended anyone giving birth?
The brigadier looks around at the women, pushes her scarf down again.
Well?
I've helped birth plenty of cows, but no humans, says Margareta, matter-of-factly.
You can stay also.
Natalia's screams from the bed refocus their attention. Sweet, beautiful Natalia, Silke thinks. Josie kneels down beside her, pushes the damp blonde hair off her face.
How bad is the bleeding? Silke asks.
There was a lot of it when I went to the latrine on the worksite. Help me, please. Silke, save my baby.
She wants the baby, Silke notes. There is something within Silke that understands. If this happened to her, she might cling to that idea of life too. But it won't happen to Silke. She doesn't think her body is able to get pregnant. Josie looks pleadingly at Silke.
You know what to do?
Silke keeps her face blank, serious.
We will do all we can, Natalia. We need to take your clothes off so we can see how you are, all right?
15 women gather at the door, wrapped up, eager to get away, keen not to bear witness to tragedy. Silke, Josie, Elena and Margareta tend to Natalia as best they can. A guard delivers 2 towels and 2 sheets. Greeted by the screams of Natalia, he throws them into the hut without a word. While the rest of the hut is having dinner, Natalia gives birth to a baby boy. He makes no sound. He gives no movement. Taking one of the towels, Silke wraps his little body in it and places him in Natalia's arms. The 4 women stand over her as she cries herself to sleep, clutching her son to her chest for what will be their one and only night together. Josie stays by her bedside all night. The next morning, Antonina tells Elena and Margareta to stay with Natalia. Silke and Josie are to take the baby and report to the hospital for work. Josie looks pained.
We'll look after Natalia, Josie, Elena says.
Taking the dead baby from his mother's arms is one of the hardest things Silke has done in her 20 years. In the hospital, Josie is slow to catch on. Silke finds herself spending more time teaching and doing the job herself at the expense of nursing. She perseveres and Yelena looks the other way as slowly Josie learns the art of determining what information from a doctor needs to be in a patient file, what was only comment and not for recording. She can speak Russian well now, but she struggles greatly with the Cyrillic, with the names and spelling of drugs. She is shy towards the medical and nursing staff, preferring to interrupt Silke for help than ask for instructions to be repeated. Silke, however, excels at every task. She is now expert at drawing blood. Her suturing, while not to the standard of Olga and the others in the embroidery class, is admired by her more experienced colleagues. She effortlessly combines caring for the emotional needs of her patients with their practical ones. Josie is grateful and warmer to Silke now, whispering to her in the hut as they lie side by side on the nights Boris and Vadim haven't visited. She's anxious and overwhelmed.
How will I learn? How will I keep up?
Silke sometimes does not have the energy to reassure her, though she wants to be good to her. She just knows it's possible things will get even harder, that they have to take each moment as it comes. One day they return from work and Natalia is gone. Antonina Karpovna refuses to give them answers, which Silke knows is not good. Usually they know when a woman has gone to the hole because it is a warning to the rest of them. Silke cannot stop the images of women leaping onto electric fences in that other place, preferring a quick death to the hell on earth that was the camp or the gas chamber they knew awaited them all. The blankness is coming over Silke, cold and flat as snow on the ground, and she just wants to lie down. But she knows what Natalia meant to Josie. She sits by her and silently offers a hand for her to hold until she falls asleep. Winter seems relentless, all-consuming in its freezing darkness, but weeks become months. The seasons make their dramatic changes and once again small flowers push their way through the melting snow and ice. The light in the hut goes out and the sun remains high in the sky. A second white night summer has arrived. There are a few more changes in the hut, besides Natalia's departure. Two of the original women get involved in a fight. When a guard attempts to break them up, he is struck. The women are sent to the hole and do not return. Three young Ukrainian girls arrive and sleep in their beds. Olga, Elena, Margareta, and Hannah remain. The walls of the hut are covered in the women's craft. When a piece deteriorates due to the damp conditions, it is quickly replaced. The lace adorns the collars on the women's coats, their dresses, the edge of pockets, on their hats and scarves. It is a small reclamation of an identity, a femininity, an expression of something other than a functional body put to work daily. Silke has managed to avoid being alone with Hannah for months, until one evening when they are all walking back from the mess to go straight into the hut. Silke slows, telling Josie she'll be in soon. "Are you all right?" Josie asks, frowning at Hannah standing next to Silke. "Yes, of course," Silke says, forcing a smile. Josie shrugs and walks on, leaving Silke and Hannah alone. Silke takes a deep breath. To her surprise, Hannah does not look threatening, but vulnerable. She licks her dry lips, her eyes darting about. "In the hospital," she says tentatively, "you have drugs for pain, right?" "We do, but they are limited. We only use them when we really have to." "Well, you have to get me some," Hannah says. Her eyes flare in their sockets, desperate. "There's not enough," Silke says. "You know the consequences," Hannah growls, digging her hand back into the flesh of Silke's arm until it hurts. "If you don't get me a steady supply, I will tell everyone in there," she nods towards the hut, "that you not only fucked the Nazis, but you stood like an angel of death in a fur coat and watched, and did nothing, as thousands of your kind were killed before your eyes." Despite the mild weather, Silke's insides turn to ice. She begins to shake. She wants to explain to Hannah.
"I was 16. I did not choose any of it, any of this. I simply stayed alive."
But no words come. And she knows, too, how they would ring out hollow and desperate to her hutmates, how they would not be able to stand to be around her, how she would seem cursed, wrong. She does not want to steal drugs badly needed by patients for Hannah, but she also can't lose her friends, her only solace. And what if Yelena found out about the death block too? Raisa and Luba, she might lose them, and her position. She wouldn't be able to bring extra food for her hutmates, helping to keep them strong enough to do their grueling work. Everything would unravel. She sees on Hannah's face that she has guessed Silke's thoughts.
"I'll see what I can do," Silke says in a flat voice, defeated.
As she's about to go back into the hut, to lie down and try to close her mind to this dilemma and all that it has brought up, she hears a voice call her name. "Silke! Silke!" It is Boris. She turns as the stocky, ruddy-faced Russian bounds over to her. How can she deal with him right now? Their relationship has gradually changed. He tells Silke often that he cares for her. She forces herself to tell him the same, for her safety, but she never means it. Many times, when he visits, he just wants to be held, cuddled. He tells her about his childhood, one of rejection, of never knowing the love and comfort of caring parents. She pities him. She wonders if her feelings for men are to be only fear and pity. Her own childhood was full of love and attention, her parents always interested in what she said, appreciating the stubborn, willful daughter they were raising. There is a remnant of this sense of family and belonging, tucked deep down, that cannot be touched. Her father was a good man. There must be other men like her father, like Gita's Lale. Love against terrible odds is possible. Maybe just not for her.
She thinks again of the messenger she has seen in the hospital, his kind, dark eyes. But can a look of apparent kindness really be trusted? She doesn't even know his name. It is better that she doesn't.
"Walk with me," Boris says firmly. She doesn't know what will happen if she protests, so she goes. He takes her to a part of the camp she and the others have avoided, an area full of men, often arguing, always fighting. Boris tells her he wants her to meet some of his friends. He wants to show her off. For the first time since her arrival in Vorkuta, Silke is genuinely scared. She knows Boris is a powerful trustee in the camp, but the vile comments of the men who attempt to grab her and touch her as she walks past them make her fear that he cannot protect her. One of the others has a young woman with him and is savagely having sex with her in full view of his comrades. The calls for Boris to prove his manhood and take Silke the same way make her break from him and run. Catching up to her, Boris insists he would never do anything like that. He offers a heartfelt apology, confirming what she has suspected. He cares for her. But how can he care for her when he does not know her? He only knows her as a body, face, hair, limbs. As they move away from the others, the girl's screams follow them. Silke begs Boris to let her go back to her hut. She wants to be alone. She is turning blank and numb. She assures him it is nothing he has said or done, trying to keep the fear out of her voice. She needs time by herself. Alone, curled up on her bed, facing the wall, even with her blindfold on, sleep will not come. Absurd images appear and warp in her head. An SS officer, his rifle adorned in lacy embroidery. Gita and Josie sitting beside a mountain of crushed coal, searching in the grass for a four-leaf clover, laughing and sharing a secret as Silke looks on from a distance. Yelena leading Silke's mother away from the truck as other women are piled on it, nearly corpses already, and bound for their death. Boris dressed in an SS commandant's uniform, his arms outstretched, dead flowers being offered to her. She sobs silently at the hopelessness she suddenly feels for her future and the people who will never be in it.
Auschwitz-Birkenau, 1944. Silke steps foot outside Block 25. Four SS officers stand near the idling truck, just outside the gates of the brick courtyard, waiting to take the overnight residents of her block to their death. The women are slowly making their way out the gate, dead women walking. She pushes through them to approach the two nearest SS officers.
"Two have died overnight. Would you like me to have their bodies brought out for the death cart?"
One of the officers nods. Silke stops the next four women.
"Get back inside and bring out the two who have cheated the gas chamber," she snarls.
The four women turn back into the block. Silke follows them in, pulling the door behind her, not quite shutting it.
"Here, let me help you," she says.
The women look at her as if it's a trick. Silke frowns.
"They would have stuck their rifles in your belly and dragged you back here if I didn't say something first."
The women nod, understanding. One of them has died and is lying on a top bunk. Silke climbs up to her and, as gently as she can, lowers her down into the arms of two of the waiting women. The body weighs nothing. Silke climbs down and helps properly place her across their spindly arms, then adjusts the woman's meagre clothing to give her a degree of dignity in death. Once the two dead women are carried outside, Silke watches the truck drive away. She is left with the squeak and scratch of hungry rats. She will go inside in a moment and put on her clean nylons, bought with bread. If he comes to visit, he likes her clean, and she has a favour to ask him, for her friend Gita, concerning the man she loves. Silke finds love a strange word. It bounces around in her mind, but doesn't land.
But if Geeta is able to feel it, Silka will do what she can to preserve that. Before going inside, she glances in the direction of the gas chambers and crematoria. When she started here, in this hell on earth, she'd always sent a prayer. But now the words will not come. In her hut, desperate to drive away the memories, Silka wills sleep to come. 13 years to go. Chapter 10. A small child screams. Patients and staff turn as the door to the ward is flung open and a woman runs in, holding a little girl. Blood covers the child's face and dress. Her left arm hangs at an impossible angle. Two guards follow, shouting for a doctor. Silka watches as Yelena runs to the woman. She is well dressed, clad in a warm coat and hat. Not a prisoner. Her arm around the woman's shoulders, Yelena ushers her to the end of the ward. As she passes Silka, she calls to her, "Come with me." Silka falls in behind the procession, the child still screaming. In the treatment room, Yelena gently takes the child. She places her on the bed and the child appears to go limp. Her cries subside to a whimper. "Help her! Help her!" the mother begs. "What's her name?" Yelena asks calmly.
"Katya."
"And what's your name?"
"I'm Maria Danilovna, her mother."
"They are the wife and daughter of Commandant Alexei Demyanovich Kuktikov," one of the guards offers. "The officer's hospital is at capacity because of the ward being rebuilt, so we brought her straight here." Yelena nods, asks the mother, "What happened?"
"She followed her older brother up onto the roof of our house and fell off."
Yelena turns to Silka. "Get some wet cloths and help me wipe the blood away so I can see the extent of the injuries." A small pile of towels rests on a chair next to a basin. Silka drenches two of them. There is no time to wait for the water to warm up. Cold will have to do. Handing one to Yelena, she follows her lead in wiping blood from the little girl's face. The wet, cold towel seems to revive her, and her screams resume.
"Please, help my Malishka, please," sobs Maria.
"We are helping," Yelena says softly. "We need to clean some of the blood away to see where she is hurt. Be careful of her arm, Silka. It's broken and will need to be set."
Silka glances at the arm hanging over the bed next to her and repositions herself to avoid it. Bending down, she speaks to Katya in a quiet, soothing voice, telling her she is not going to hurt her. She is just cleaning her face. Katya responds, her whimpering now accompanied by shivers that rack her small body. "Get a blanket quickly and cover her. We need to keep her warm." Silka grabs a blanket from the end of the bed. Folding it into two, she carefully places it over Katya, again murmuring, telling her what she's doing. "I can see the site of the wound. It's on my side of her head. It's quite a gash. Keep cleaning her face, Silka. I'm going to get some supplies." Yelena drapes the end of a towel over the right side of Katya's head, covering her right eye. Maria steps in front of Yelena.
"You can't leave her. You're the doctor. Send her."
Silka's heart races. At some point today, she has to get to the dispensary that contains all the medicines and medical materials needed on the ward, though she dreads what she's planning to do.
"She won't know what to get. I'll be right back. In the meantime, Katya and you too, Maria Danilovna, are in good hands with Silka."
Yelena leaves the room.
"You might want to hold her hand," Silka tells Maria, who nods and takes Katya's uninjured hand in her own.
Silka wets a clean towel. When Yelena returns, Silka is talking to Katya.
"Katya, my name is Silka Klein. Dr. Kaldani and I are going to take care of you, do you understand?"
A small grunt comes from the little girl.
"Good girl. Now, Katya, can you tell me where you hurt? We know your head hurts, and we know your arm hurts, but does it hurt anywhere else?"
My leg,"
splutters Katya. "Good girl, anywhere else?"
"My head hurts, Mama. Mama."
"I'm here.
my Malishka. I'm here. You're such a brave little girl. You're going to be all right.
Yelena places the tray she has brought in on the bedside table. From the bottom of the blanket, she lifts it gently to look at Katya's legs. They are covered in thick stockings, and no injury is visible.
Silke, help me take her stockings off so we can examine her legs.
Whatever pain Katya is feeling in her legs is not significant enough for her to react, as Yelena and Silke each remove a boot and a sock. Yelena examines her legs. The right one is showing signs of early swelling and bruising around the knee. Yelena moves it carefully. Katya doesn't respond.
I think it's not serious. Let's get back to her head.
What about her arm? Silke asks.
We'll get to that. You're doing really well, Silke. Thank you for asking about her other injuries. Often children this young don't respond. You have to find the injuries yourself, so well done. Pardon me, Maria Danilovna, but how old is Katya?
She's nearly 4.
A lovely age, Yelena says quietly, as much to herself as Maria. Yelena removes the towel from Katya's head. The gaping wound has stopped pulsing blood, but the red raw edges look nasty. She hears Maria gasp. Yelena pours antiseptic over a wadded bandage and gently places it over the wound. Silke continues to attempt to wash the blood from Katya's hair.
You have beautiful hair, Katya. It goes with your lovely face.
Keep talking to her, Silke. Maria Danilovna, this is what we have to do. I cannot take care of Katya's injuries while she's awake. I will give her an injection to put her under, examine her more closely, then move her to a more sterile room to stitch her head wound and take care of her arm. It is broken between the elbow and the wrist and will need to be pulled into place properly before it can be plastered. Do you understand?
I think so. Are you sure? You need to put her to sleep, though. What if she doesn't wake up? I've heard about people being put to sleep by doctors and not waking up.
She needs to be asleep, Maria Danilovna. You have to trust me.
Where are you from? Where did you get your training?
Maria asks Yelena, and Silke senses the anxiety beneath her bravado.
I'm from Georgia, and I was trained there.
I'm also from Georgia. They have good hospitals there.
We must talk some more, but for now, I need to take care of Katya, Yelena says, and then quietly,
do you want to tell her she is going to have a needle and go to sleep, or should I?
Turning to Silke, Maria says,
let her. She seems to be able to calm Katya.
Although Silke has heard the exchange, she looks to Yelena to repeat exactly what it is she is to say to Katya. She doesn't want to get it wrong and frighten the girl. She strokes Katya's face as she tells her what is going to happen. Katya doesn't flinch as Yelena injects the anaesthetic, and both she and Silke watch as Katya's eyes flutter and close. When Yelena is convinced Katya is deeply asleep, she removes the blanket and starts to cut away her clothes. Layer by layer is discarded on the floor. With only a singlet and underpants remaining, Silke becomes aware of the two guards in the room.
Leave, Silke says to them firmly.
They don't need to be told twice.
As the door closes behind them, bellowing can be heard in the ward.
Where is she? Where is my Malishka? Katya!
My husband, whispers Maria.
Silke watches as the relief on her face at hearing her husband's voice is replaced by what looks like fear. Maria backs away from the bed. The door bursts open, and Commandant Alexei Demyanovich Kuktikov storms into the room. Scrambling behind him, a senior doctor enters, squawking,
Alexei Demyanovich! Alexei Demyanovich! I am in charge!
The commandant arrives at the bed and registers his daughter's broken, bloodied body. He looks to his wife. What happened, Masha?
Alyosha!
Yelena comes to Maria's defence.
She was just playing, Alexei Demyanovich, and had a fall. It looks worse than it is. I have put her to sleep so I can take care of her, but I assure you, she'll be fine.
The commandant listens without interrupting, but the doctor who followed him intervenes.
Alexei Demyanovich, I am in charge here. I am so sorry I didn't know your daughter was here.
Turning on Yelena, he shouts,
no one told me the commandant's daughter was here. I will now take over.
Maria cautiously walks towards her husband.
These two angels have taken care of our little girl. Let them finish what they have started.
Alexei looks at his wife. And are you all right?
Excuse me, pipes up the doctor. I am the most experienced doctor here, and it is my duty to take care of your daughter, Alexei Demyanovich.
Without looking at him, the commandant answers. If my wife says she trusts these two to look after Katya, then they will, with my thanks.
He turns to Yelena. You look like the doctor.
Yes, Alexei Demyanovich. I am Yelena Georgievna, or Dr. Kaldani.
Turning to Silke. And you, the nurse?
She is not even a nurse. She's a...
The male doctor interjects.
A nurse in training, Alexei Demyanovich, but a very good one, Yelena says.
The commandant attempts to run his hands through the matted, bloodied hair of Katya. He bends down and kisses her gently on the cheek.
I'll go back to my office and leave her in your hands. Have someone report to me when you have finished, and I will organise where she is to stay. She's not staying here.
He turns to Maria.
Stay with her, my dear.
I was never leaving.
Silke and Maria follow the bed with Katya on it as it is pushed by Yelena to the operating room. Silke has not been in this part of the hospital before. The door at the end of the ward always seemed forbidden territory to her. A short corridor leads to two small anterooms feeding into a slightly larger room with a big overhead light. Silke heard about such rooms in Auschwitz. Chills overcome her. Her breathing quickens.
It's all right, Silke, Yelena says. This is where we operate. Now come on, I need your help.
While Yelena stitches and bandages Katya's head, manipulates and plasters her arm, examines the bruises which have now appeared on her legs and small body, none of which require medical attention, Silke stands with Maria. At the sound of the bones in the girl's arm crunching back into place, Maria buries her head in Silke's shoulder. Silke takes a sharp breath, then places a loose arm around the distressed mother. In the recovery room, Silke stands beside the chair while Maria sits with her head on the bed beside her daughter. When Katya wakes, crying, her mother comforts her as Silke runs to get Yelena. A quick examination by Yelena determines that Katya has come through her procedures well. Silke notices Katya looking at her quizzically, as if she doesn't know who she is.
Hello, Katya. I am Silke.
Katya registers her voice. A small smile crosses her lips.
These are the two angels who took care of you, Maria tells her daughter.
Katya continues to look at Silke through one opened eye, the other partially covered by the large bandage encircling her head. Silke is uncomfortable with the attention from the girl. Now the action is over, she's much more aware of the child's smallness, her vulnerability, how it could all have gone so wrong.
There's a truck outside waiting to take the girl home, says a guard from the doorway.
Silke is glad she cannot hear the idling truck, a sound from her nightmares, a sound she would hear from her room in Block 25, the death cart waiting for its passengers. The guard steps aside as two men enter, carrying a stretcher between them. Yelena lifts Katya from the bed. The stretcher is placed on the bed, and Yelena lowers Katya back down, carefully placing her broken arm across her small body. Blankets are piled on top of the delicate little frame. As the men lift the stretcher and walk towards the door, Maria turns back to Silke.
If there is anything I can do for you, please ask. I mean it.
Thank you, Silke says. My freedom.
That is an impossible request, she knows.
Thank you for letting me care for Katya.
I wouldn't let anyone else care for my children, or myself, but you and Yelena Georgievna.
She smiles. Silke smiles back.
Goodbye, Maria says.
As she is leaving, Silke studies the elegant woman she has spent the past few hours with. The delicate lace collar on her dress and the silver locket and chain hanging around her neck. The colourful belt that pulls her dress into her tiny waist and the shiny buckles on her shoes. It has been many years,
since she saw a woman dressed so beautifully. Images of her mother, dressed similarly, come into Silka's head. A memory to cling to. But that is followed by thoughts of her mother at the very end. A memory she can't bear. It takes until the final hour of her shift for Silka to find an excuse to go to the dispensary. She takes one container of the pills, slips it into the extra pocket sewn into her skirt, where she normally puts food to take back to the hut. It is just one container, she thinks. She just can't face up to this relative peace, this position, these friends, being lost. As she steps outside after her shift, she glances over towards the administration building. She sees the messenger, the polite man with the brown eyes, walking across spot-lit grass. He raises a cigarette to his lips, pauses his walk, closes his eyes and inhales. Despite his layers of clothing, his scarf and hat, his worn boots, there is an elegance to him, in the small pleasure he takes on the inhale, in the exhaled smoke rising above him and his gloved fingers poised in front of his mouth. Silka feels something shift inside her. She keeps walking. Chapter 11. Name: Stepan Adamovich Skliar. Date: September 14th, 1947. Time of death: 10:44. Placing the blanket over Stepan's head, Silka walks back to the desk area, slowly flicking through Stepan's file. A couple of recent entries catch her attention and she reads on. Ukrainian prisoner, presented 3 days previously with stomach pain. Nothing identified on examination. Watch and wait. Aged 37 years. She looks for the treatment plan. There isn't one. Investigations, nil. Pain relief, occasional. A doctor is sitting at the desk nearby. She hands him the file.
I've noted the time of death for this patient, Gleb Vitalievich.
Thank you, just leave it there.
He indicates a pile nearby. If you would like to sign it, I can file it immediately.
The doctor takes the record from her and flicks quickly through it. He scribbles something on the front page and hands the file back.
Thank you, I'll file it.
With her back turned to the doctor, Silka looks at the entry. The doctor's illegible signature beside her notation. Then the words, cause of death, unknown. Silka looks back at the doctor, noting how little he is writing in any record, how he is not reading previous entries, and how the pile of records that was in front of him when she approached is now reduced to 3 or 4. With anger growing inside her, Silka doesn't see Yelena approaching until she stops in front of her, blocking her path. Is something the matter, Silka? Silka takes several moments to think of how to respond.
Why do you go to great lengths to save some people and not others? How do you decide who should live and who should die?
Yelena frowns.
We try and save everyone. You do. Not every doctor here does.
Yelena takes the file from Silka, scanning the last entries.
I see what you mean.
It's possible that investigations were made and simply not recorded.
Possible, but I don't think so.
Yelena looks at Silka seriously.
You need to be careful, Silka. The administration needs functional bodies to work, and so saying anybody was deliberately hindering the sick from getting better so they can serve Mother Russia is a more serious accusation than you may realise.
Silka takes back the file with a little more force than she should have. In the small filing room filled with boxes, she goes to place Stepan's file in the current open box. Taking the last two files out, she quickly looks at the entries. Both causes of death do seem valid to her untrained brain. She will keep her thoughts to herself and heed Yelena's advice not to pry. After all, it's not as though she is doing everything right by the patients. Though she tries her hardest, there is that one container of pills slipped into her pocket every now and then.
Are you religious? Yelena asks Silka one day, standing near an unconscious patient in the corner of the ward,
who has just been looked over by Gleb Vitalievich. It is dark outside, and snowing.
No, Silke answers quickly, though it is not the full answer. Why?
Well, she is keeping her voice low. As Silke remembers, one does not talk about religion in the Soviet Union. Any religion.
It's the season where some religions celebrate, but I wasn't sure if it meant anything to you.
No, not me. Silke looks down at the patient. Talking about this means talking about a lot of other things. Talking about the annihilation of her people. About how hard it is to have faith the way she once could.
You?
Well, in Georgia, it was always a time when we would gather with family and have food and music. It's the first time Silke has seen Yelena look properly sad, wistful. She is always forthright, practical, in the moment.
Are you just not Christian?
No, not a Christian. Dare I ask any other religion? Silke pauses for a moment too long.
It's all right, you don't have to answer. You know that if you ever want to talk about where you come from, just know I will not judge you.
Silke smiles at her.
A long time ago, my family did celebrate, around this time of year, also with food, lots of food, lights, blessings and songs.
She looks around her, fearing someone may overhear.
But it is hard to remember.
Deeply and instinctively, Silke still often reaches for prayers. Her religion is tied to her childhood, her family, traditions and comfort. To another time. It is a part of who she is. At the same time, her faith has been challenged. It has been very hard for her to continue believing when it does not seem that actions are fairly rewarded or punished, when it seems instead that events are random and that life is chaotic.
I understand, Yelena says warmly.
I wonder if anyone is lighting a candle tonight for this poor fellow, Silke says, wanting to move the focus from herself.
Let's hope so, says Yelena, for all these wretches.
But you didn't hear me say that.
Silke nods and takes a step away from the bed, before turning back to Yelena.
If I was ever going to talk about my past, I would like it to be with you. She has surprised herself by saying it. It is too much of a risk and too difficult. And even if Yelena, the most compassionate person Silke has met, could handle it, what if she told others? Even the patients in the hospital wouldn't want her around. Someone who has overseen so much death.
Whenever you're ready, come and find me, Yelena says.
The ward is quiet for a moment, unusually so. Silke stands by the window, watching the snow flurry in the blue-black sky. Closing her eyes, she sees her family sitting around the table. Her beloved father reciting blessings, the lighting of the menorah, the pure joy of being together. She can smell and taste the latkes, potato pancakes fried in oil that will be eaten for the next 8 days. She remembers the excitement of being a young girl given her first candle to light. How she pestered her father many times to be allowed to light the first one. How she never accepted his explanation that it was the man in the house who did it. Then the memory of the time he relented, telling her she had the courage and determination of any boy, and as long as it was their family secret, she could light the first candle. She then remembers when that was. The last time she sat with her family to welcome and celebrate Hanukkah.
Hanukkah Sameach, she whispers to herself. Happy Hanukkah, my family. Otska, Mamichka, Magda.
Bardejov, Czechoslovakia, 1942.
Happy birthday. Pack the new coat Mama and Papa gave you for your birthday, Silke. You may need it, Magda whispers as the sisters each pack a small suitcase.
Where are we going?
To Poprad. We have to catch the train there for Bratislava.
And Mama and Papa?
They will take us to the train station and we will see them when we come home.
We must be brave, little sister. Keep Mama and Papa safe by going to work for the Germans.
I'm always brave, Silke says firmly. Yes, you are. But tomorrow, when we say goodbye, you have to be especially brave. We will stay together and you can look after me.
Magda winks at her little sister.
Silke continues putting her very best dresses into the suitcase. She will make her family proud. Silke has contained all this for so long. She's not sure if it is the darkness or the quiet, or Yelena's open face, but she has to run to the nearby linen room. She closes the door, heart racing, and drops onto the floor, burying her face in dirty, soiled linen so no one can hear the sobs that are escaping her. With no sense of how long she's been down there, Silke struggles to her feet. She smooths down her clothing, wipes her fingers under her lashes, making sure it is not obvious that she has been crying. She needs to get back to work. She takes a deep breath and opens the door. As she leaves the room, she hears,
"There you are! I've been looking for you!"
Silke squares her shoulders. Striding towards her is the doctor she despises for his attitude and complete lack of compassion in treating his patients, Gleb Vitalievich. She has often wondered if it would be possible to compare the survival rate of his patients with other doctors. She knows he would be the worst by far.
"Watch bed 9 for time of death. I'm going off for a while. I'll sign it off tomorrow."
She watches him walk away.
"I know about you," she thinks,
throwing silent daggers at his back. Bed 9 is the unconscious wretch by the window. Silke leans in and, with detachment, feels for the pulse in his neck. She is shocked to feel a strong, healthy thud-thud, thud-thud. She peels back his right eyelid and notes the pinprick-sized pupil, sees a flutter of movement. Looking around, she observes that Yelena and the two nurses present are occupied. She can see Josie's back in the filing room. The man's file lies at the foot of the bed. As she is about to pick it up, she hesitates and pulls the blankets away, revealing his feet. She scratches her fingernail down his right foot. It twitches. She reads his file. A single line. Name: Isaac Ivanovich Kuznetsov. December 24th, 1947. Found unconscious in his bed, unresponsive, brought to hospital. Not for treatment. Isaac, a Jewish name. Silke tries to control her breathing. No. No. Not today. Not this man. She will not sit by and watch him die if there is something that can be done to save him. From the dispensary, Silke finds the medication she has used many times before to wave under the noses of unconscious patients to try to bring them around. A foul-smelling substance she has often thought could wake the dead. Gently, she slaps his face, calling his name. A small whimper escapes his lips. She holds the cloth containing the substance close to his nose. She pinches his nostrils shut for a moment or two before releasing them. Being denied oxygen briefly, his nostrils flare open and inhale. Immediately, he responds. His eyes open as he gasps for breath, choking. She gently rolls him onto his side. Soothing words float from her lips to his ears as he turns his eyes upward towards her. At that moment, Josie comes over to see if she can help.
"Is Yelena Georgievna available?" Silke says.
Josie reaches out to Silke, a look of concern on her face.
"Silke, are you all right?"
Silke has forgotten already about the linen room, though she does feel tired, emptied out.
"I am, Josie. I just need to help this man."
Josie looks around. "I'll find her," she says. Silke is glad that she and Josie have become close again. Josie was quiet and subdued and closed off for a long time after Natalia disappeared, but she began to enjoy conspiring with Silke to sneak food back to the hut
especially when winter set in. They've been pretty lucky with the food, and sometimes Silke has to remind herself to be careful. Mostly the women do not leave so much as a crumb, but if the head guard, Klavdia Arsenyevna, came in at the wrong time, it could be the whole, or worse, for Silke and Josie. Not to mention Hannah, whose pills are swapped from pocket to pocket, and then Silke assumes sewn into something, her mattress, perhaps, by night. Josie returns a few moments later with Yelena. Silke explains how she was meant to be watching the patient to record time of death, but was concerned no attempt had been made to work out why he was here. When she did some tests of her own, she discovered he had a strong pulse and good reflexes. She used the smelling substance, and he has regained consciousness. Yelena listens intently, reads the sole entry on his file. She draws breath through her teeth.
You have interfered here, Silke. Gleb Vitalievich isn't going to like this.
But I do think you've done the right thing, and I'll take a look at the patient, but I can't guarantee there won't be consequences for you. Remember what I said. You two go. It's time to finish up, and I'll see you tomorrow.
You won't get in trouble, will you?
Silke asks Yelena. No, I'll try and make it look like he recovered on his own, she says. Silke looks down at the bewildered man lying in the bed.
You'll be fine, Isaac. I'll see you tomorrow.
Silke and Josie go to get their coats, their scarves, their hats. That night, Silke hardly sleeps. How can saving a man be a problem? Why is it that her life always pushes her to be confronted by or to embrace the deaths of others? Why is it that even if she tries, she cannot change this? Is there any point ever getting attached to another person? Josie, Yelena, they are always in danger. When Silke arrives on the ward the next morning, she is greeted by Gleb Vitalievich and a bulky-looking trusty thug.
I want her out of here, he screams on seeing Silke.
The trusty moves towards her.
She's an interfering, mixed-up Zechka, who does nothing here of any lasting good. She'd be of better use in the mines.
Yelena and the other staff stand back, watching the rant. Silke looks pleadingly at Yelena. She shakes her head, indicating there is nothing she can do. Josie stands close behind Silke, silently supporting her. The trusty grips Silke's upper arm, steering her to the door.
It'll be all right, Silke calls out to Josie. She's going, Gleb Vitalievich says. Now, the rest of you, get back to work.
Silke glances at bed 9 and sees Isaac sitting up. She throws him a quick smile as she is forced out of the ward. The trusty follows her all the way to her hut.